than 50,000 names are carved on April's Menin Gate of soldiers who have no known graves, just their destiny and date, witness and last testament, name and rank and regiment, is now all that survives from so many squandered lives.
And for every name inscribed, the poor bereaved were left to mourn the passing of each one who died with no white cross on tended lawn. No place to go to contemplate the sacrifice, the wicked waste, no footprint left to show where once they trod. Allegedly known to God.
It'll be about a time of remembrance in November of 2025 that you'll be listening to this, 105 years since the cenotaph in Whitehall in London was unveiled, and on the same day the unknown soldier was buried in Westminster Abbey. And one of those soldiers, one of those veterans from the Great War, was there when the unknown warrior was buried. But he couldn't see what was going on because he was blind, and his name was Herbert Thompson. He'd served in the West Yorkshire Regiment. He said this: "The ceremony in the Abbey left an indelible impression on my mind, a feeling of ineffable sadness. Yet there was a message of inspiration and hope. I felt as if the spirit of the unknown warrior had whispered in my ear, 'Courage, brother, hope on.' I was one of the lucky three chosen by ballot from 170 blind inmates of St Dunstan's. I understood all. In addition, every step and every movement was explained to me by an accompanying guide. The atmosphere was impregnated with meaning." In his mind, he could see exactly what was going on, and his mind and his memory also took him back to those days on the Western Front. He says, "Clear-cut pictures of France and Flanders rose up before me. It stirred the most poignant memories. I felt with my comrades almost ashamed that I'd given so little, while he was laying sleeping by us, had given all. I stood near the tomb of a mighty king. Not far away were 100 VCs. I heard them limp to their places and knew who they were, the solemn rolling of the drums and the slow martial music of the mass bands meant more to me, perhaps, than to other people. When the long roll of the Ravel echoed away in the distance, I thought a cloud had passed over my head and had been chased away by the sunshine. Then, with my comrades, I was granted a privilege denied to all others. Each of us had been given a chrysanthemum before we left St Dunstan's. Others had placed their wreaths at the foot of the coffin. A hand guided us, and we were allowed to bestow our tributes on the coffin itself. We spoke in the name of our blind comrades, and I felt a supreme emotion as my fingers brushed the resting place of the unknown hero. I came to the Abbey glad that I'd been chosen from among so many. I went away sorrowing, but with a message of hope locked in my heart."
From Ypres, Arras, Aisne and Somme, six unknown soldiers were exhumed. A blindfold general picked one there and reverently they brought him home. Six black horses drew the herds through silent London crowds immersed in deepest thought, belief, or wishful prayer that this might be their own boy there.
The metal tires on the carriage wheels played the tuneless requiem. The sky as grey as bayonet steel above the sombre hatless men. One more enemy to kill, that remaining sense of guilt that through it all somehow they had survived. Return to mothers, sweethearts, wives.
Familiar streets, their own backyards, their medals and all praise ignored. Proud to be his honor guard and walk with him their true reward. While far from pomp and circumstance, across the autumn fields of France, the trenches start to slowly fill and fade, the bloody page turned by the ploughman's blade.
So welcome to yet another episode of a podcast that I, Terry Wenham, called Tales from the Battlefield. And when I started these podcasts, I think it was in February 2022, I had no idea what was going to happen. I thought that only a few people would listen to this. But I'm delighted to say that we've done over 150 episodes now. And I noticed the other day when I downloaded the figures that we'd reached the 250,000 mark. Quarter of a million people listen to this all over the world. I'm really honestly staggered and humbled by the amount of people that do regularly listen. Some episodes, of course, have more listeners than others, depending on the subject. But I would like to think that it really is nothing to do with me. It's the stories that we tell. And there's no greater story, I suppose, than the story of the unknown soldier or the unknown warrior that we've just been listening to there. And a year ago, we welcomed John Nicol, who'd written a book called The Unknown Warrior, his own journey into discovering what had happened to that lone man that was brought back from the battlefield and buried in Westminster Abbey in November of 1920. That book a year ago came out in hardback. And this week, to coincide with the 105th anniversary of the unveiling of the cenotaph and the burying of the Unknown Warrior, it's been produced in paperback by the publishers. So John came back on the podcast to talk a little bit more about the book, and it gives us an opportunity as well to look at a couple of the passages that are contained within the book as John describes the journey of that unknown warrior from his initial burial place somewhere on the Western Front across the Channel to Victoria Station, who spent his final night above ground, to the actual ceremony itself in Westminster Abbey. Now, in Jordan's book, he actually travelled out to the Western Front, starting his journey at High Wood, but then he followed the footsteps, if that's the right word, of the unknown warrior. And he went to the town 50 miles south of Calais called St. Paul. And in his book, he says, and I quote, "Twinned with the town of Hebden Bridge in West Yorkshire, St. Paul is a hilly commune with fewer than 5,000 inhabitants. A few miles away lurk the concrete remnants of one of those massive bunkers that once housed Hitler's V1 flying bomb programme. At the end of the First World War, it had become the headquarters of the Directorate of the Graves Registration and Inquiries, and it was a place where people were doing their absolute damnedest to identify where the missing were buried." John says that he scanned a bleak, grassless space opposite the town's railway station. Three French flags flutter in the breeze. I know it must be here somewhere. My gaze is drawn to a stone cross surrounded by dead flowers. It turns out to be a monument to Charles de Gaulle, the leader of the Free French in the Second World War, and still a patriotic hero for many. Then, a few yards away from the cross, set in the midst of a bed of rose bushes, I glance a small white headstone. It doesn't look like much, considering what it commemorates, but here, on the slab of grey slate attached to the front, is the inscription I've been searching for. And this is what it says. The body of the British unknown warrior was selected at St. Paul on the night of the 7th and 8th of November 1920, taken to Westminster Abbey and interned there on the 11th of November 1920. John says, surrounded by soulless concrete buildings and the roar of traffic speeding along the road behind me, I take in these words. Turning away, something at the base catches my eye. Half hidden in the dry earth is a sun-bleached, woolen, commemorative wreath. A printed card tells me that it was left by the Royal British Legion's cyclist branch during a recent commemorative cycle ride through the battlefields. The faded, rain-blurred scrawl in royal blue ink, more than 100 years after the event this stone commemorates, makes me pause once more. We shall not forget. So welcome back to the podcast again, Tales from the Battlefields, John. If you'd just like to introduce yourself, first of all, and tell us a bit about your background, what made you write this book, The Unknown Warrior?
Hi, Terry. Thanks for having me back on again. Very kind of you. So some of your listeners might remember the fat northern bloke that was shot down during the Gulf War in 1991 and paraded on TV. Well, that was me.
That was you.
That's nearly 35 years ago, Terry. Mm. Or as my wife says, 35 years and 5 stone ago. Yeah. Although, to be fair, Manjaro is working for me at the minute. So,
it's all going that way.
So I served in the Air Force as a tornado navigator. I did 16 years and I left in 96, I think, and I started writing. And so The Unknown Warrior, which has just come out in paperback, was my 19th book. Who'd have thought that? And what I'm doing is I'm telling the story of the Tomb of the Unknown Warrior in Westminster Abbey. So I'd seen the tomb many times when I've been at services there, but I never really understood the story. You know, so beneath this stone lies the body of a British warrior brought back from the battlefields of France, along those lines. But I never fully understood what it meant. And so I kind of embarked on a journey to tell that story. So I found myself going back to the battlefields of France. And what I've tried to do is, rather than try and tell the whole First World War story, because that's impossible and many people have done it better than me, I tell the story from the one little scene, well, I use that term advisedly, of one battle. So I go to Highwood, which obviously played was a huge story as part of the overall Battle of the Somme, which is what was an overall huge part of the First World War. But I tell the story of one guy that goes missing, what it meant to his best mate, what it meant to his family, what it meant to his family not to have any concept about where their loved one was. I tell that story all the way through to the scheme that Reverend David Railton came up with, to who had buried many of the dead at Highwood, with the scheme to bring back one body of one unknown man to represent the 500,000 missing. And that was the genesis of the book. And it turned into, you know, the paperback that you see now, or the hardback that came out this time last year.
It was a year ago.
Yeah.
So since we last spoke, when we talked about Railton and the Unknown Warrior, then embarked on this national tour, and I met you towards the end of it here in Northampton. Yeah. When it's fair to say you were flagging a bit at that stage when I saw you in the bar.
It was like being back in the military again, mate. Yeah, my back is knackered after ejecting during the Gulf War in 1991, and as you get older, it gets more knackered.
Yeah.
I was away from home for 6 weeks. I think it was.
Yeah.
And it was, and listen, don't get me wrong. You know, it was a lot of people have a lot worse life than I have. You know, so I am whinging a bit, but, you know, being in a van, and it was just in a van, and I had somebody that was driving me and setting the stage, and, you know, and it wasn't just me standing on a stage giving a talk. It was a theater show he set it up, and then, but we would get in the van at 11 o'clock at night. So after we, you know, I met you in Northampton, I can't remember where we went, but we would simply crisscross the country, get somewhere at sometimes 1, 2, 3 in the morning, stay in a hotel, get out, go and set up in another theatre, do a show, get in the van, go somewhere else. Mm, and it just went on and on and on and on.
But the passion that you showed for the subject and for Railton and all these men, it comes through in the words in your book, but it also came through when you were telling the story. Obviously, you said that you told it multiple times, and I saw you at the end, but you were still as passionate about it as the end.
Well, thank you.
And I know as you went around the country, you met some of the podcast listeners as well, didn't you?
Quite a few people came up and said, oh, I heard about your on the show with Tales from the, you know, with Terry's Tales from the Battlefield. You know, so you know, thank you for kind of doing that early on in the before I went on tour. And it was, you know, as I say, mate, it was a privilege to go and do it. And we sold, I don't know, so many books. It was untrue, but obviously, you know, it was a theatre show. People were spending their money to come out on a cold October or November night to, you know, to come and sit in a theatre and listen to me hanging on. And so it was important for me to keep the enthusiasm going, to tell the story properly. It's a moving story. You know, the books had some fantastic reviews, and everybody who saw it said it was a very moving show and really told the story.
And I'll tell you what, where are we now? It was in May of this year. I was guiding a battlefield tour with just three people, a private battlefield tour. And it took us to what's called the Forgotten Front, the Forgotten Battlefield, between just not far from the French-Belgian border. And we went to a village called Erquinum, just over the border into France. And there, as I came out of the cemetery, there's a church, and there was a memorial there to the chaplain David Railton in
really?
Erquinum. Yes. Did you not
so
know
I,
about
so
that?
I don't even think I've heard that before. I've interviewed his fa- I interviewed his late daughter-in-law, who sadly died just after the book came out last year, and his grandson. You know, and I don't think any of them have ever mentioned a memorial out there.
Yeah, on the memorial, it said that this is where he had the idea of the Unknown Warrior.
So obviously, and I tell that story in the book when he'd come back from the battlefield and he went back to his billet, single cross. And I think it was Here Lies the Body of a Soldier of the Black Watch, was it? Was it? It was one of the Scottish regiments.
And I couldn't believe it when I saw that. There was a VC memorial there. There were some guys in the cemetery that were from Northampton, which is why I went there.
Fantastic,
in the first
place.
And then all of a sudden I saw this unusual memorial, and it had been put there by the locals. The local people had put it there.
Fantastic.
This memorial.
Oh, amazing.
You know,
you
just...
Amazing.
And, you know, had we not had this conversation, had I not read the book, I wouldn't have even noticed it. So,
but it was, and so I think that was, if I remember correctly, like, you'll correct me if I'm wrong, I think that was 1916, after a battle early, you know, in 1916. You know, but he that was in his mind, so all the way through he remembered that and he said, I thought and thought and wrestled with thought. When in one of his private letters, he talked about how he came up with it, and he remembered that from, and I think he was talking in the middle of 1920, when we were approaching the second anniversary of the armistice, when the cenotaph, as we know it now, on Whitehall was going to be unveiled. And that's when he decided, I'm going to do something about this. I'm going to write, who should I write to? Should I write to a general? Should I write to a field marshal? No, I'm going to write to the Dean of Westminster Abbey and see what he says. And so when you read the story of how the Tomb of the Unknown Warrior came about, it is an astonishing story, the likes of which I just don't think you'd have now.
No,
you know,
no.
I just don't think you'd have it.
So returning to a passage from John's book, he talks about going back to St. Paul on the 8th of November 1920, as a General Wyatt has been meticulously preparing four field ambulances, and they clattered to a halt outside four cemeteries dotted across the Western Front on the battlefields of the Somme, Arras, the Aisne and Ypres. Each vehicle was accompanied by an officer and soldiers equipped with shovels and sacks. There was a Padre George Kendall, a Methodist priest, who had once had to bury three Welshmen during an artillery bombardment, and he'd been tasked with assisting one of the exhumation parties. They were instructed, he said, to dig up a body from a grave marked Unknown British Soldier. Kendall understood the need for secrecy, even regarding the general area of the exhumations. No one, and this is very important, he declared later, was to know from which district a body had been taken. The graves which were opened in all the theatres of war were marked only by a cross stating that an unknown warrior lay there. If the regiment or division in which the man had served was specified, the grave remained untouched. John says in his book, with little other personal testimony available, I can only imagine the scenes unfolding across the former battlefields. It must have been a very strange exercise for all concerned. The exhumation parties, trained to identify bodies, were now doing the exact opposite. They were digging up the long dead, decomposed or still decomposing remains of former colleagues. Their job, presumably, was to double-check boots, uniform, insignia and personal effect in the quest for a corpse that absolutely could not be identified in any way. It can't have been an easy or pleasant task. We continued our chat about David Railton, the man whose inspiration it was to bring back this unknown warrior from the battlefields.
It's just a chance thought, really. It's a thought that went through his head one day. And here we are now. It's 105 years later, isn't it?
Yeah, 105.
Your paperback book is going to coincide with the 105th anniversary. And all those incredible stories that came out of people that were there on that day.
Absolutely.
How do you think public perception has changed then? Is it possible to interpret how it was very raw at the time, it would have been, because there's people there directly affected by the whole war. And then, of course, it changed again in after the Second World War. But how do you think the public and veterans' perception of it now? Because there's still veterans like yourself that are there, aren't there, on Remembrance Sunday?
Oh, God. Well, so, I mean, there's kind of a couple of different things. So, obviously, the Tomb of the Unknown Warrior was an adjunct. It was an add-on to the unveiling of the cenotaph. So the king was already going to unveil the cenotaph.
Yes.
That was planned. And there was not opposition at first. The king was not all that keen, King George V, on the idea of a tomb for an unknown warrior. And he talked about, do we really want to, 2 years on, do we really want to bring all of this pain up and all of the suffering and all the memories? And of course, the whole point was, yes, the public did want to do that.
Mm. So it's a way of grieving, wasn't it? It was a whole way of grieving, which the king understood because he'd been to Tynecott, he'd been to the battlefields, he'd come up with lots of ideas about remembrance. So he was concerned for the right reasons, wasn't he?
And of course, he said, is this the right way? And of course, the whole point was that it was, I think. So the body, the coffin of the unknown warrior, was paraded at the cenotaph on the 11th of November, 1920, the king put a wreath on his coffin, and then the cenotaph was unveiled, and then the coffin of the unknown warrior was taken to Westminster Abbey for the interment, the burial ceremony. And again, I think there was the crowds were so enormous. They were stretching all the way from Westminster Abbey all the way back, all the way up Whitehall, 10, 15, 20 wide on either side of the cenotaph as they walked past the cenotaph and then walked on to Westminster Abbey. And it was something in the order of 1.5 million, over the course of a few days had visited the cenotaph and then onto the Tomb of the Unknown Warrior. So it was incredibly important then. Mm. As, for me, one of the things that really summed it up was the amount of people that wanted to go to the ceremony for the burial of the unknown warrior. Mm. So obviously, wives who'd lost their husbands, wives who'd lost a husband and a son, wives who'd lost a husband and all of her sons, and then there was families. And this one young boy had written a letter saying he wanted to go. And he said, I want to come to see the service because the man in that coffin might be my daddy.
Yeah,
and so then when you hear that, then that's when you realise how important that was. Mm. And still, there's a story in the book where a couple of days afterwards, there's two young boys at a school, I think it's in the East End, are caught fighting. And they're caught fighting. One of the men's up with a broken arm or something. And they, they're obviously in trouble and the headmaster's why fighting. Say, well, my mum said the man buried in Westminster Abbey is my dad. And the other little boy said, well, my mum says he's my dad. And he was every man. He was everybody's brother.
And that was the whole point.
Cousin,
wasn't it?
Uncle, father.
It's incredible to think whenever I've only been to it a few times on the Remembrance Sunday or on the 11th, and I remember being there actually when the last Fighting Tommies were there,
Yes,
the three of them. They
of
went
course,
off
yeah.
into Whitehall and they had their
Yeah,
lunch with the then Prime Minister, and I remember being there, and I remember thinking that's the end. I didn't know at that time it was going to be the last year, but I remember thinking it could be, looking at them, it could be the last page of
Yeah.
that history being closed, which it was. I can't remember what year it was now, 2009, something like that. So they'd all gone at that stage. We're now going to see very, very few Second World War veterans there this year. And then in a couple of years, they'll all be gone as well, which means, therefore, that the veterans that will be attending the ceremony and going to see the Unknown Warrior in Westminster
Memorial
Abbey
Hall.
in the future will be nobody that remembers either of the two World Wars.
Well, it's an interesting point because, so first of all, obviously there are no First World War veterans. There's actually quite a lot of Second World War veterans, and I don't know how many because nobody in government, there's no record. That was RAF Coningsby in the Petwood Hotel where the
Oh,
Dam Busters flew for the Battle of Britain Memorial Flight end of display season dinner. And there was about half a dozen World War II veterans there. The oldest was 104. So if you think about, so the end of the Second World War, 1945. So what's that? 80
81.
years. So if you were, even if you were a kid, a kind of 18, and you just served in the last little bit, you're going to be knocking 100 on the door, 99, 100. So that's going to be the youngest. So I would say that as we already have some existing 104, 105-year-old veterans, there's probably, it's a terrible thing to talk about, but it's a reality. And I was speaking about this to the 104-year-old veteran, Colin Bell, who'd flown mosquitoes over Berlin. I said, Colin, when you go, when he's 104, he's in amazing shape. But, when there's going to be another probably 5 to 10 years of veterans, but, and this is important, Terry. So if we look at the Cenotaph slash the Unknown Warrior, more and more people want to attend the service on the 11th of November.
This is what I
It's
was wondering.
more people. So I've been going for what, 20, nearly 20 years, and I march with the Royal Air Force Ex-Prisoner of War Association. And in the aftermath of the First World War, I think we had something like 10,000 prisoners of war. Well, there are, and we would have maybe 100 or so marching with us 20 years ago. Oh, and now there's two remaining that we know of, two or three, and they're both 103 years old, and they're too frail to come to the Cenotaph and stand around for 3 or 4 hours. And so there are now none of our World War II veterans, but there are still some. You'll find a sprinkling of 100, 101, 102-year-old veterans with their groups. So it might be a squadron association, a regimental association. There are still a few who go, but the crowds, they're bigger now than they were 20 years ago.
It used to be all about, when I was growing up, about Remembrance Sunday, which wasn't
Yeah.
always on the 11th. This is
No.
the point you're making. And
Yeah.
then they introduced the 2 minute silence, didn't they, on the 11th? And I think
Yeah.
maybe that was the catalyst for it. And it's brought, and also the centenary of World War I. I think that inspired a lot more people to wonder what the 11th of November was all about, as well as
Well, I
Remembrance
mean,
Sunday.
there's a very interesting point about that. So if you go back again, when I left the Air Force in 96, and the 2 minute silence on the 11th of November, no, but it just had gone out. Obviously, when it was in 1919, when it started, it was huge and it went, but over the years and kind of especially in the 60s and the 70s, in the 80s, so when I was in the Air Force, we never, ever, ever
No,
had 2 minute silence on the 11th, ever.
no,
When
no.
I left the Air Force, I headed up in 1990. I found the old newspaper cuttings in 1996, I think it must have been, the Royal British Legion's campaign to reinstate the 2 minute silence. So it was me, John Major, Sir John Major, the Prime Minister, as he is now, my ex-Prime Minister, and I can't remember who else. And we had a big campaign to reinstate the 2 minute silence.
Oh, brilliant.
And now it is everywhere. Every TV program, every newspaper, every news channel, every radio channel. And I was, I'm not claiming credit for it. I was there kind of as part of the campaign. But Terry, that we're not talking that long ago, 1990, 30 years
30
ago,
years,
nobody of very nobody or not nobody, that's unfair. There was not a national remembrance on the 11th of November at 11 a.m. And now it is,
And now
and that's because,
the traffic
and
stops
oh,
in all the
absolutely, it's
provincial
everything.
towns.
Absolutely. And so, again, you know, so I was on the Saturday. I'll be at the cenotaph on the Saturday, which will be the I think the 8th or whatever it is before the Saturday before Remembrance Sunday. I will be with the War Widows Association because they have, and I, you know, I obviously know some of the ladies involved. I will be there with them, and we'll have a service, and Whitehall will be closed, and we will have a we'll have the band of the Southern Highlander pipes and drums and the RAF Halton Cadet Band, and there will be a quite a large parade, and Whitehall will be closed off for the War Widows. And do you know
Brilliant.
what? When the War Widows was set up in 1971, the War Widows Association, to help with camaraderie, to help force change, they were not allowed to attend the remembrance service on Remembrance Sunday because
Goodness.
they weren't military. So they weren't allowed to go to the service on Remembrance Sunday. So when they started in the 70s, they were running across the Whitehall traffic, putting their posies down and their markers,
Running
and
back again.
running back through. And if you've been on Whitehall, on a, you know what it's like. So nobody cared about the War Widows then. Never mind 2 minutes silence. We didn't care about the War Widows.
Returning to John's book, it's now midnight on the 8th of November 1920. He says, lying in the darkness of the deserted chapel in northern France, the four sets of remains, carried in as equals, awaited their destiny. General Wyatt's selection lay in a fresh pine coffin before the altar. The others remained in their sacks, on stretchers, each covered with a Union Jack. Alive, these four men had almost certainly never met. Now, exhumed from the four different battlefields, they were bound together in the same unlikely story. Across Britain, countless bereaved families were lying in the darkness too. What comfort might they feel to believe that their son, their father, their brother was in that coffin, in the cool simplicity of a silent chapel, no longer lost to the thick mud of no man's land? The four were about to embark on very different journeys. One was to be guarded overnight, transported in state to London to be buried amongst poets, artists, and monarchs. His final resting place already awaited him, prepared that very day behind barriers set up in the nave in the dry sandy soil that lay below the abbey floor for perhaps 1,000 years. The other three would soon be returned to the earth, but the secrecy surrounding the unknown warrior's selection and the whereabouts of the three unused bodies had to remain sacrosanct. At 3:30 p.m. on the 9th of November 1920, we've now reached Boulogne on the coast of France. The roads approaching the port were lined with soldiers, British and French, as if visiting royalty. It must have been a strange experience for Wyatt and his team after working so hard to keep their activities under wraps. Now, following weeks in the shadows, here they were in their rundown cavalcade, blinking in the glare of an impressive military turnout and the wooden cameras of upteam photographers, all eager to get the first shot of the unknown warrior's cortege. But this next stage had once again to be conducted behind closed doors. The warrior was still in his naked pine coffin shell, unfit for public display. There was still some work to be done before he was ready to face the press. He was then taken in to a chateau to await his journey back to England. John says, eventually the escort vehicles from St. Pol swung into the quadrangle, followed by the battle-scarred ambulance. A bearer party of British and Dominion soldiers was waiting to carry the Union Jack-wrapped coffin up to the chateau's library. The men had been carefully selected to represent all branches of the army, the Royal Army Service Corps, the Royal Engineers, the Royal Garrison Artillery, the Australian Light Horse, the Canadian Infantry, the 21st London Regiment, the Machine Gun Corps, and the Royal Army Medical Corps. And then the coffin on board HMS Verdun glided into port of Dover. John says that the busy harbour seemed frozen in time, and at that very moment, a partial eclipse of the sun, the moon shadowing one side, added to the spectral magic. The fishermen, sailors, and townspeople gathered near the Admiralty Pier had not been allowed into the quay. A few dockside staff stood dotted around the Navy boys, almost hidden behind the long rank of soldiers standing with their backs to the ship, rifles reversed. A docker, William Chandler, was there, ready to help with the lines flung from above. Many of those assembled had their own experience of loss. As the Verdun drew closer to her mooring stern first, there was a muffled roll of drums from the band of the Royal Irish Fusiliers, and then the majestic opening chords of Land of Hope and Glory filled the air. Played softly, almost caressingly, the proud music of the motherland brought a shrill of emotion to every spectator, declared the Daily Mirror. It was an impressive moment. Another correspondent noted this. HMS Verdun was still. The air was still. The waters of the harbour and of the channel beyond were still. Not a flag fluttered. Not a seagull flapped its wings. I do not remember a scene so static, except the 2 minute silence last year. No doubt the commander of the Verdun gave his orders as usual. But it was in undertones that reached no ear amongst the onlookers. There was not a sound and not a movement. This for many seconds that seemed like an hour. So tense were those moments of waiting. It was with this wonderful, vigilant silence that Dover first received back on English earth its unknown warrior. As I read that, it really does bring it home to me, I don't know about you, that this was a very important part of our history. So important to those men and women and children at the time, thinking that perhaps this is their relative. And of course, by listening to this and reading John's book, we ensure, as long as we tell the stories to those that follow us, that this story will never be forgotten.
So the introduction of the 2 minute silence in the 90s, recognition of war widows, recognition of PTSD that people like yourself have suffered and everybody else, and the things that various charities, lots of different military charities, are doing for people. And also the fact that so many young people I've found in recent months are very, very interested in what happened and how we remember. I know that from my own experience of going into schools. All these, when we hear all this bad news and how people disrespect history, these are all positives, aren't they? I think there is a lot to be encouraged about.
You know that the news now is, it looks for the worst case scenario. And, you know, to say that something is terrible, you rarely hear anything that is good. But if you like you or me or involved or know people or see, especially social media, you know, I know there's a lot of guff on social media, but you regularly see young people who are celebrating kind of, you know, history and are interested in quite a few, you know. I think the youngest person to come to the Unknown Warrior Theatre show was 13.
Really?
And I said, are you sure? You know, because obviously it's a little bit of kind of goriness in there. There's some, obviously some photographs of the battle. And there was obviously there was a young man and a young woman, and they were with their parents. I said, and they said, no, they're fine. They're really interested. And they came up afterwards, kind of 30, to be out at 10 o'clock at night on a cold Wednesday.
Yeah.
A big thing.
Yeah.
But they were really interested and really interested in the story, and there were quite a lot of young people, you know, kind of teenagers, 19, 20, 21, who came along as well, really interested in the story.
And I always say to them when I go to the schools or when I've been on coach tours in the summer, guiding coach tours with Ledger, we've had quite a lot of teenagers and even younger, 11, 12.
Yeah.
And I get them involved in what we're doing. You know, I get them to do readings and tell some stuff. And I say to them at the end, it's very, very important that you represent your generation and go back and tell these stories, because in 20 years' time, you'll be an adult and I won't be here.
Well, so when I was out doing kind of a tour around High Wood, where's the Canadian War Memorial? And so I went there, and there were poachloads and poachloads of school kids there.
Yeah,
poachloads, all going around, all walking through the trench systems, all having kind of history. So it was really good to see that going on.
So going back to John's book, we've now reached 8:30 p.m. on the evening of the 10th of November, 1920. And the Unknown Warrior has reached Victoria Station. John says in his book, the light still burned at London's Victoria Railway Station as the evening rush cleared and commuters hurried home. On the rain-slick pavements outside the station, temporary barriers had been erected, and the crowd, now several rows deep, was silent but restive. Thousands had already gathered, and the police were doing their best to control the unexpected numbers. One journalist noted that these were the same people, nearly all women, who'd gathered here in the war, bidding their menfolk farewell, or waiting, hoping for their safe return. Men had gone out with their last memories of England from here, he wrote. The ladies in the buffet used to tell the men that Victoria meant victory, and so they shouldered their heavy pack and headed to their train and went out to France. Whispers came from behind the barriers, then a wave of emotion swept through the assembled crowd beyond the gates. The soldiers on the platform stiffened, and they waited. At 8:32 p.m. precisely, the red tail lamp of the small shunting engine and its two carriages could be seen slowly approaching platform 8. The few civilians allowed onto the platform removed their hats, and a small detachment of 16 Grenadier Guardsmen saluted. From behind the barriers came the smothered sound of weeping. The pain and longing were visible in many a woman's eyes. "It may be," come one whisper. "Oh, I wonder," came another. With a gentle groan, the ghost train glided to a halt.
Thankfully, we'll never know if he was constant, strong or frail, scared or brave in equal parts, country tanned or city pale, a carefree youth or thoughtful lad, not wholly good, not wholly bad. Bomb does not judge how you played your part. A bullet stops a lion's heart.
In John's book, it's the same place, Victoria Station, Platform 8, but this time it's August 2023. The bronze plaque that commemorates the unknown warrior's arrival here and the outpouring of public grief that attended it is bolted to the wall between Platforms 8 and 9, close to the left luggage office. That plaque says, "The body of the British unknown warrior arrived at Platform 8 at 8:32 p.m. on the 10th of November 1920, and lay here overnight before interment at Westminster Abbey on the 11th of November 1920. Going back in time again, it's now 9:20 a.m. on the 11th of November 1918. That scene is once again Victoria Station. In the book, John says, "Alongside Platform 8, the bearer parties took a step back and slowly marched to their position. The light was becoming more dazzling now, and the polished steel and brass of the carriage shone like burnished gold. In the yawning space around the empty station, the vast bodyguard representing innumerable regiments, ships and squadrons of the armed forces was arranging itself in two great serpentine columns. They assembled on each side of the concourse in their half ranks of three, leaving space between them for the gun carriage and the bearer party to advance. By 9:20 a.m, the Royal Air Force was in place. The army had formed up by 9:23 a.m, with the Royal Navy joining the procession at 9:25 a.m. By the time they'd all formed up, the mass ranks stretched the whole length of the platforms and back again. In attendance was Field Marshal Earl Haig alongside General Lord Byng, the popular commander who had brilliantly led the Canadians to victory at Vimy Ridge in 1917. We now move on to the Mall. It's 10:20 a.m. Golden rays of autumn sun filtered through the treetops in the Mall, noted the Sunday people, and gilded the shrapnel helmet lying on the coffin. What a sight it was, sombre, simple and serene. On the north side of the Mall, near the Victoria Memorial, stood a fleet of charabangs, open motor coaches, containing blinded and wounded soldiers. They may not have been able to see the procession, but in their mind's eye they could see their dead friends, clear as day. And they might not be able to salute, a number of them were missing their arms, but they would offer the appropriate greeting to the unknown warrior in their hearts. He was one of them, and they were him. As the distant throb of the drums approached, the first sections of troops lining Buckingham Palace end of the Mall lifted their rifles, spun them upside down, and stood with their heads bowed. Then the waiting mourners heard the music of the mass bands. There was a wave of movement as each man and woman respectfully bared their head, despite the November chill. Ahead in Trafalgar Square, a whisper began to spread through the crowds of perhaps 50,000 people who were gathered there. He is coming. And now the crowd sobbed in genuine grief, without shame or restraint. As I read that, a chill has gone through my own body as I read those words that John has uncovered. I can only imagine how those people must have felt on that cold autumn day 105 years ago. I keep saying that, don't I, over and over again on this podcast. Perhaps that's why we do the podcast. And while this is happening, back at St. Paul, the three other unknowns that had been exhumed from their graves were quietly taken back to the battlefields and reburied. John tells us that on arrival, the bodies were placed in an old trench which was filled in. The padre held a short service. That's all they had time to do. They went back to their headquarters in St. Paul. The whole exercise had taken them 12 hours, and they were very, very tired. So leaving John's book for a few minutes, I've uncovered an article that was written by a man called James Bone, and he was the London editor of the Manchester Guardian, and he was there on that day, and he recorded his thoughts and what he witnessed. He says, "Today he, the man from France, does not stare wildly round before dashing through the barrier where someone else waits crying for him. We know you well, dear comrade. We know that to you these honours would seem the most gigantic of jokes. If they were paid to yourself, your laughs would burst a coffin. But you understand us. It is hundreds and hundreds of thousands we are honouring in your person. Because you are nameless and were forgotten, we chose you. You represent them all." The music had stopped and there was a pause. Then the king stepped forward with a wreath and placed it on the coffin beside the steel helmet. Then the choir sang, "O God, our help in ages past." And another pause, and the Archbishop of Canterbury's voice was heard reciting the Lord's Prayer, in which the king and the people joined. The king then unveiled the cenotaph. The unknown warrior continued on its slow journey towards its final resting place. 1,000 bereaved women were sitting waiting inside the cathedral, their mourning lightened by the flowers and wreaths on their knees. About 100 VCs, Victoria Cross recipients they mean, came in and formed an avenue from the choir gate, the unknown's guard of honour. The heroes were ranged without distinction of rank. A naval commander, stiff with a gold braid, would be next to a private soldier, and among the soldiers you saw a famous officer like Freyberg, shoulder to shoulder with an ex-private in civilian clothes. 14 wives and mothers who received the Victoria Cross for their dead menfolk had places of honour. And then the ceremony itself. Down the lane of khaki and naval blue and hospital blue, the guardsmen carried the coffin. On it lay the steel helmet and a wreath. The soldiers set it down over the grave. The king stood at the foot, facing west, the royal princess near him, and filling the whole space behind, a notable gathering of cabinet ministers of the war period. Mr. Lloyd George and Mr. Asquith were standing together in the forefront. The pallbearers took up their stations, soldiers down one side, sailors down the other. The famous generals Haig, French, Byng, Horn, Wilson came a private in the guards, marching with solemn rigidity. He was not officially a mourner, but at that moment he represented the ordinary soldier. The customary ritual of burial took only a few minutes. The dean handed the king a silver shell, in which was soil brought from France. The king cast it upon the coffin. From the east came a roll of drums, then the clear call of the reveille, a cheerful challenge carrying us on to the life that must be lived. The king's wreath lay at the head of the grave. It was over. He then talks about the VIPs leaving the abbey, walking past the coffin. Then the women left their seats and began that long file past of the bereaved that was to last all through the day. The rich women and the poor, for all the open grave meant exactly the same thing. A woman plucked a white chrysanthemum from a bunch she carried and threw it in the tomb. This example was quickly followed, and soon the purple carpet was thickly scattered with flowers, white and red.
With softest cloth and gentlest broom, to sweep and wipe cathedral dust, like dry tears on this marble tomb. Take care, for he was one of us. In perfect irony and grief, the bride's bouquet becomes a wreath, and wrapped beneath dark angels' folded wings, Tommy Atkins rests with kings.
Well, I think that's a good closure then for what we're talking about, because you know, your book has taken it from the beginning of the story, and we're bringing it up to date with what you're doing on your theatre tour. There'll be young people reading this. I'm going out telling the stories, and I think that's what we're trying to do, isn't it? We're trying to inspire not just people of our generation, but the people in the next generation to tell these stories when we're gone. And you know, the fact that this book is going to be in print is never going to go away, is it?
Well, so it's what I've done all the time, Terry. You know, so you know, is for me, it's keeping history alive.
Yeah,
and it's telling. It's telling history in a really accessible way. It's not dry. You know, I know. So I'm not a historian. So I don't say, and then the third flank of the 73rd of...
I don't understand it.
You know, so I just don't do that. You know, I use personal experiences.
We'll do.
That's book number 19. I've just finished book number 20. So it's out. It's not out until May next year. So it's, you know, it's with a copy editor in the minute. So I'm having my homework marked.
Okay.
But it's called The Blitz, when World War II came home. So it's telling the story of the Blitz, but not from the East End of London that we've heard so often.
Yeah.
It's focused on my mum, who was 13 when the war started, up on the banks of the Tyne in North Shields, just outside Newcastle.
Yeah,
and she never really spoke about her experiences, and so I've been researching that, going into the archives, finding out what happened. You know, simple things. You know, so obviously there was a lot of children evacuated, but one thing my mum did say was, her mum said, "You're never going to be evacuated. If we all die, we're going to die together at home." Okay, and they never even went to a shelter. They kind of hid under the big oak kitchen table when the bombs went off.
Do hear this?
One thing I remember talking about was a terrible incident where, you know, I think over 100 people had been killed, and I found out what that incident was. And it was at a nearby air raid shelter in the bottom of a lemonade factory in a couple of hundred yards from where she lived, and it took a direct hit from a German bomb, and I think it was 107 people died. In 107 civilians in one incident, one of the greatest losses of civilian life. and I found two survivors.
Really? They're still
Yeah,
with us
just
today.
talk. So the lady is now 99, and so I went to see her, chatted to her brother, who she'd rescued from the, the everything came down on top of them. And then when you then are bringing history to life,
And why
and for me, it's so important.
would the Germans be targeted in somewhere like Newgate? It's the
Well,
shipbuilding, isn't it? And the
no. So
factory.
this is, so first of all, they're targeting the time
Yeah.
and the shipbuilding,
Yeah.
but the notion, and I've heard a lot of this when I did another one where a school was bombed in East London,
Yeah.
and a lot of the online chatters, oh, they deliberately targeted the school, and
No.
I don't kind of get too involved with it. I said, but you clearly know nothing about World War II
They
weaponry,
can't. They can't,
because
can they? They can't
nobody
target
can
school.
target you. Just there was no ability
No.
to do it that way on
No.
one of those mass raids, not at that time. It
No.
just so specialist units did later in the war, but still not to drop it on a 10 foot
Not
school.
really. No.
So
No.
and so it was a stray bomb dropped. So it was a I can't remember what the aircraft was, but they actually think they found out some of the facts. So it dropped four bombs. Two landed on the banks of the Tyne, very close to where my mum lived. One landed on a house a little bit further north and killed two people, and one just went through the roof of this factory, right through the floors, detonated. And because it was a lemonade factory, so all the
The
vats, the
glass.
cauldrons,
Yeah.
and the machinery brought it all down into the
Yeah.
cellar where a couple of hundred people were sheltering, and
Oh.
all the records are there, so
Oh.
you can read the records of. So who was died, what they were wearing when they died, how they identified the bodies, where the bodies were taken to. And it's astonishing to
It
then
is.
read history that is living history.
And if you hadn't done that, no, probably no one would ever have done that, because as you say, they
Well, I
concentrate
mean,
on
so
London.
as and you have the right to be annoyed with people like me. There are local historians embedded, and there's a chap called Peter Bulger in North Shields who had written about this incident, but it's written in a kind of
Exercise
a
book.
self-published book. And it's but it's a fantastic author, and he has been so kind, you were so kind helping me out, but it is people like me that get the recognition for
Yeah.
kind of telling the overall story. But I absolutely rely on
Yeah.
historians who have spent their life
Yeah, yeah,
digging into
yeah.
archives and history and learning the stories,
But then
and
you've
then
got
some
skill then,
idiot
and you've
like
got
me,
those skills that you've
well,
honed over years. You bring it all
yeah
together, access to the
yeah
publishers, and your
yeah
backstory helps as well. And therefore it helps, tens of thousands, hundreds of
Yeah.
thousands of people hear these stories that they wouldn't have
Yeah.
heard before.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely.
Absolutely
I hope
incredible.
so. Kind of 20,000 words into book number 21. So the Blitz, Unknown Warrior is out now in
Yeah.
paperback. The Blitz is out in May. And
Yeah.
then book number 21 will be out probably the following May if I get it finished in the next kind of 6 or 7 months.
I better let you get on then.
Yeah, all right.
Thank you, John, and we'll see you on
Cheers,
the next
Terry.
one. Thank you.
Great. Thanks, mate. All the best to you.
I have my own memory of seeing the Unknown Warrior's tomb in Westminster Abbey. And it came, I don't know, probably about 10 years ago now, and it was Remembrance Sunday. I was extremely privileged and thankful to be invited by one of the wardens at Westminster Abbey to attend the ceremony on that day. And as we sat there on those wooden seats, just as those people had done all those years ago, outside it was very dark and damp, just as it was on the 11th of November 1920. And then, just as Big Ben, a short distance away, chimed 11 o'clock, there was a slither of light shone through the stained glass windows of Westminster Abbey, and it shone on the congregation, just as it had done all those years ago. It was almost though history was repeating itself. It was meant to be, as quite often it is, isn't it? When we think about what's gone before and those that have gone before us. So, if you listen to this around the time of remembrance over the next few days, perhaps you'll have your own thoughts. I certainly will. But I don't know about you, but I'll be thinking about those blind veterans from St Dunstan's who were there. Some of them, if you remember, were missing limbs. But they paid their respects. They went on with their lives. One can only wonder how they live the rest of their lives. without sight, perhaps without an arm or a leg. But they did, but they'll all be gone now, won't they? We know that. But we still remember them. We remember the unknown warrior. We remember around this time of year, our own particular soldier, perhaps. And we'd remember them by the playing of The Last Post.